Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to another fabulous year here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I am so pleased that we are with you now in 2014. Had a little hiatus over the holidays. Hope everybody had a great one. I hope everything went well. Hope 2014 is kicking off the right way. A lot of exciting things going on here with the magazine, radio show. Everything coming for you here in 2014, and we know no better way than a two-hour season, I guess you want to say, premiere on Suspense Radio with four fantastic authors. Going to kick it off with John Trudell, going to Paul Parsons, M.L. Rowland, and then ending it up with New York Times bestseller Lisa Gardner. And it all happens right here, live, on Suspense Radio that starts right now. Kicking off another fantastic year here in 2014 with Suspense Radio. We are going to jump in right now to our first guest, author John Trudell. We have had him on for his previous book, God's House, last year, and now he is back with his latest book called Soft Target. We want to welcome John back to the show. So, John, thanks so much again for coming on, being the first guest of 2014. How you doing?
John, I am doing wonderfully, and I am especially honored by hosting me for the lead segment, and proud to talk about my book, and this is my third novel out, Soft Target, one we missed that came out last year. It was called Privacy Wars, which got quite a bit of national attention. It won three national awards, and got kind of intense debate. It predicted both the NSA and the IRS scandals. And I met interesting people, and that led directly to Soft Target. I guess the first thing I'll say about it, I'm going to give your listeners a link. They can look at images, just www.johntrudell, J-O-H-N-T-R-U-D-E-L.com. www.johntrudell.com. All my books are up there. And even the first chapters are there for free if anybody wants to see them. But the reason I suggested that, the thing I'm proudest of with this book so far is three things. Number one, if you look at the image of the cover, our first book, way back when, God's House, won a national award just for the cover. I love my cover artist. This one is going to win an award. I'm pretty confident of that. If you look at it, you see this kind of horrific setting with a low setting sun in the distance, smoke coming up, a really desolate, hostile area. Silhouetted against the setting sun is a black helicopter leaving. It's a special ops helicopter. It's the last one out, and in the foreground is the silhouette of my main character, who we call 20 Mike. His name is Mike, Mike Mickelson. He's a Marine officer, and he's still there. This is a scary place in the Mideast. The last copter is leaving, and he's stuck there. There's reasons for that. Love that cover image, and I think I'm just very pleased. The second thing that is astonishing to me is on the top of my cover, I have a blurb from Tony Hillerman, the famous author,
right,
friend. Tony was so supportive of my novels. He died in 2008. But I'm going through my files, and I found this very encouraging note, a kind of a dark time when I was trying to get started, and Tony was encouraging me. And I found that and dusted it off and sent a copy to his daughter, Anne, who's now an author herself, of course. And she says, yeah, you could use my dad's quote, so I put it on the cover. Okay.
So might as well. I mean, yeah, if you're allowed to use it, you might as well put it on the cover when it's Tony Hillerman.
Absolutely. Tony was one of the most gracious, and he was just a super person, and very supportive of upcoming authors, and he helped me with some advice at a time when I was about ready to give up the whole thing. And then the last thing about the novel still has nothing to do with what I wrote in it, is on the back I have a blurb from a fellow named Captain Larry Bailey. Who is Captain Larry Bailey? A couple years ago, nobody would know, but the name is getting more common. He has been on TV a number of times. He was he's a retired naval captain who used to command the SEALs, and he helped me with my book way back when. And he retired, and this thing called Benghazi happened. Larry was
right.
Livid. He was just absolutely livid. Some of the people who died over there were people that were friends of his. And he came kind of out of retirement, formed a group. That community very rarely says anything. They seldom even talk to each other, let alone go public. And they're the most non-political bunch of people you've ever seen. Well, long story short, Larry co-founded a group called Special Operations Speaks. You spell all that out, and it's their website. And they're the lead group pushing on Congress for a select committee to investigate what happened. Turns out that 33 Americans got out. All of them had security clearances. All of them are under orders to not testify, and they're looking at 20 years in prison if they testify to our own Congress. That's why a select committee is needed. So Larry's working on that. He helped me with the book. He's got a lot of notoriety. It's helped me and some praise, and it's helped me with awareness for my novel. So I'm going to cut to the content and some of the words I wrote inside if that's appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, well, basically my theme is another pairing of a male and a female. My novels tend to all be set a few years in the future, and they have some normal human beings, but exceptional people, who are trying against they're in strange situations and desperately trying to work through issues and find out what's going on before they get killed. In this case, my female lead is Jerry Patton. She's kind of a technical geek. She works for the National Security Agency on a very classified, very controversial project. And what she's trying to do is come up with an electronic system to allow a virtual Congress. The idea being, right now, a single point attack could take out our whole government. Like back during 9/11, if that plane that went down in Pennsylvania had made it through, it could have taken out Congress. And so this is a system that allows us to go back to what it used to be like, where people who were elected would live with their constituents and go in to vote every once in a while, except if this ever worked, it would be secure and they could do it electronically. So that's the mm-hmm. technology behind my novel. It is resisted by a bunch of people. It is being sabotaged. And finally, the president of the U.S. assigns this kind of burned-out, injured, invalided-out Marine officer who was a hero. They need to find something for him to do, and they assign him to kind of oversee and mentor Jerry and give her some high cover so she can get her project done. And off we go from there. Within the first day of the of him being assigned to do that, they're still trying to sort things out. He visits her at her home. It's the site of a major terrorist attack. There's a huge firefight, which they survive. But by the end of the next day, her father is abducted and disappears. So it starts off with kind of a bang. It goes through that, and I could talk more detail, but the interesting thing, it's getting spooky with my novels because I create these things in my own mind. I invent situations and project, you know, where things can go, both technology, politics, and international affairs. And
right.
Privacy wars last time, last year, like I said, it predicted. Here I am doing interviews for Privacy Wars, and it's happening in the news. NSA scandal, you know. I'm going, God, I got to be real careful what I say about this. I don't want to wind up living in the airport in Moscow. So I was real careful
exactly.
when I'm doing my interviews to take just testimony off the public record. And it's just got an intense amount of attention. Well, okay, now I do this new book just out. It's only been out for a couple of months. And what I'm talking about is a virtual Congress. And the reason I was doing it in my novel is to protect against a terrorist attack. Well, by gosh, people are talking about that. They're talking seriously about iCongress. and somebody's, reserved the website for such a thing. The idea being that we have both parties now are a little upset at this ruling class stuff in Washington where they're not accountable to anybody but the lobbyists. And they're saying, hey, these guys, you know, if you could do that, they could stay with their constituents, which was how it was back for the several hundred years, probably 150, 200 years after America was founded. Everybody would be elected by their local constituents. They would live with their people, support their wishes, and go into wherever it was, Philadelphia or
right.
later Washington, and they'd vote. And then they'd come back and report, and they'd be accountable. So there are political figures, people like, you know, the conservatives like Rush Limbaugh and other people who are just more, you know, unbiased than that are saying, hey, that would be a really great idea. That's in my novel. And the other thing is while my characters are trying to develop this system so that an attack won't take out Washington and shut down our government. Of course, an attack is planned. It has conspirators inside the government at high levels. It has a fictitious country called Bukhari, who's very sinister and very very nasty people. They're jihadists.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up with a bioweapon, which I invented. I call it camel pox, encapsulated camel pox, and yada, yada, yada. And I totally invented this thing. Well, what would make a good bioweapon for these people to use against the Americans? And the novel is in production last August when I start seeing things in newspapers from Associated Press that they found an actual disease in camels, kind of like the weapon I invented. So here I go crashing into reality again. And
right.
it has really strange, it gets you a lot of attention, and some people like your novels. It also attracts political trolls that come and beat you up and say nasty things and call you names. I'm just writing novels, okay? So that's kind of what the story's about.
And so when you're looking at, like, you know, your main character, and you're looking at when, you know, you're thinking about a story that he's going to work well in, how is that kind of dynamic, you know, running through your head to make sure that, you know, that it matches correctly? Because you don't want to have, you know, something to where it kind of feels like it's not connected. So how do you kind of go through that process?
I guess the short answer is with great diligence and, you know, a lot of interactions with my critical readers. How does it all fit together? And in my novel, a lot of thrillers are superheroes. You take some of the most popular figures in fiction. James Bond, I guess, is almost a stereotype. And they're like a cartoon character. They're invincible. They go out and they do these things and prevail against very sinister bad guys. My people mm-hmm. tend to be a little more realistic than that. They're exceptional people, but they're human, and they're working way over their heads in unusual situations. And so I used to actually work in this field, as you know, and would run into people like that a long time ago. And they would say things that, you know, here I am, let's take a hypothetical, I'm not going to name any names, a Marine, okay, works behind the Iron Curtain, becomes very expert at the Soviets and everything else. Years later, he's in charge of intelligence, has nothing to do with the Soviets, has to do with all these terrorists. Oh, my God, what am I doing? So it's a very confused mess in reality, and people have to do just heroic things to sort it out. And they're chaotic things. And somehow I have to fit this chaos of figuring out complex situations based on vague intelligence and fuzzy technology against a storyline. And I found it, before I did novels, I'd done a few, you know, nonfiction books. To me, novels are harder. I could talk about techniques I use, but the short answer is it's a very difficult process. I use a variety of writing techniques to assure that. And then I have people who are really aware of the situations and sciences that my novels touch, and I have some very good reading groups who criticize me.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, criticism, a lot of people sometimes don't take criticism well. But I think criticism is actually essential to be a better author, you know, just better and just up in your game.
Absolutely. You know, I do all the stuff with the story arcs and the scene cards, and people have – I've been to some really good classes. What I've discovered is that every major successful author I've talked to has their own unique thing that they come up with.
Right.
And what I do, it isn't just criticism. I want experts that I can trust giving me feedback. If it's a how to kill somebody, I'll have a bunch of doctors look at it. If it's something, God help me with weapons. If you get a detail wrong on a weapon, your readers will never forgive you. So I have gun geeks that help me with all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with special ops, I have people like Ari Bailey and all these kind of guys. They're just friends, you know, it's all informal, and no, I make it all up in my mind. But I have people who have some knowledge and experience who are people I trust that touch my drafts, and each time somebody, one of these folks touches it, it generally comes up with something, oh, yeah, I didn't quite interpret it that way. And they say different things. They don't say the same things. They have different viewpoints. And in today's world, I think that's important. I'm real proud of the fact, like I talked about my last novel that had been out for a while now, Privacy Wars. It won 3 national awards, but the one that I'm proudest of was an award for cross-genre. People who don't normally read thrillers are reading my books, and I view that as a good thing.
Yeah, whenever you can kind of cross, you know, different fans over from one genre to the other, I think that that's always a good thing. And I want to remind everybody here that with author John Trudahl, the book is called Soft Target. You can visit John at johntrudel.com for a lot more information. And so right now, you know, we kind of talked a little bit off the air, and you have a scene that you feel in the book is very captivating that people could really get into, that would really kind of give a great sense of exactly what they're going to, you know, devote, you know, their time to. Why don't you go ahead and read that for us so we can kind of get a better sense of exactly, you know, what you're talking about and get a little more inside scoop into the book.
Great. All right. Well, what I'm going to read is off page 48 to 49 of my paper book. It's out, of course, as all the different ebook formats. And as I mentioned in background, we have this scientist who's been working, you know, very tight security, trying to do this complex project, and it's not going well. And she's this Marine general is assigned to kind of oversee her, basically because he's been badly wounded and he's rehabbing, and they didn't have anything better for him to do. And they don't know each other. And so finally, hours after this assignment comes into place, they have to meet somewhere where they can talk privately. They choose her house. He drops by with a cup of coffee and some donuts, and they're going to get acquainted and try to figure out how to get this project going. And fine, they do that, and they're on the way to work. They're going out to NSA where she's doing the project, and all of a sudden, they're under fire. Okay, at a very nice private residence in a quiet little neighborhood. And I'll read from the book. Jerry could taste blood. She'd bitten her lip when Mike pushed her down. She groped in her purse for the gun the agency issued her. Designed for concealment and last-ditch self-defense, it only held two shots. There was another long burst of fire. She heard bullets whistling over and thunking into the house. It seemed hopeless. Why aren't we running? We're sitting ducks here. She peeked over the wall and saw him, a big man with wild eyes and a bushy black beard holding an assault rifle. The man stopped, aimed, and fired two short bursts. Kak-kak, kak-kak. Bullets slammed into Mike's tree. Jerry could hear solid impacts over the gunfire as 7.62 full-jacketed slugs thunked into the big oak. The man fired again. He clamped the trigger down, hosed bullets, gouging chunks of wood and bark from Mike's refuge. Mike was turned sideways behind the tree, pinned down, trying to present as small a target as possible. His shelter was being shot to pieces. That tree might help against pipsqueak American .223 rounds, but the heavier bullets were ripping it apart. He doesn't have a chance, Jerry thought. Her fingers touched the gun in her purse. The weapon was designed for concealment, not accuracy or stopping power. She rolled to her knees, pointed it carefully at the man's center of mass, and squeezed the trigger. The tiny gun made a muffled pop, pop. The man laughed and swung his assault rifle toward her. Jerry flattened, pressing her face into wet leaves as bullets whizzed overhead and ricocheted off the top of the wall. I'm going to die in a puddle of water on my own patio, she thought. Then the man's weapon clicked empty, and she heard Mike yell. So there's a snippet from the book.
And so what that shows is, you know, when people are seeing that, they know that the action is going to be fierce and kind of in your face and kind of nonstop. And when you're going with the pacing of something like that, how aware, when you go back and read and reread, do you kind of take a reader's point of view to say, you know, am I giving them enough? Am I making it go fast? Because political thrillers are typically not a lot of fluff and just a lot of in-your-face going straight at it.
Yeah, mine change pace, and I do that deliberately. And some people like it, some people don't like it. But the reader base that I seem to be attracting is comfortable with that. I don't have most thrillers seem to have blood on the page every three or four pages. You know, you'll take a Rambo kind of thing. Bad guy comes along, right, stands up, there's a firefight, and, you know, he dies. What I tend to do is intersperse it with history, with science, and with some thoughtful parts. People have said things about my novels that I like. I really like the comments that I get unexpectedly from outsiders. You know, these are thrillers for thinking people, that these are thrillers that kind of make you think. U.S. Review of Books, quote, this is a smart new novel for a thinking audience, U.S. Review of Books. Or William Kienhauer, who's editor of Author Magazine. John writes big books with a lot happening. So I don't have a formula kind of plot. I try to surprise my readers, and the pace changes. There are slow parts where they're trying to figure things out, and there's some background that's important. And then there are the battle scenes like... You know, and I was even surprised. I thought I was writing thrillers, but now that I'm into the market, I've got three books out, and the comments I get back are, well, 46% of my readers now are women, and they say things like, I don't normally read political thrillers, but, and they go on with a review, you know, on Amazon or whatever. and political thrillers. I thought I was writing science-based suspense. Other people have made allusions to future history or political satire, and the ones that absolutely make my day and just make me smile, a few have said that I remind them of Michael Crichton, and he was my idol.
Wow.
You know, I love the stuff he did. Each one of his books was different, which is hard to do. So I'm getting that kind of feedback. And so far, I think that's encouraging. My novels are different, and the pace changes back and forth. And some people probably don't like that. They just want to see, you know, kind of a quick read that you don't think about, and it's just one fight after another, and the good guys win. My novels are not that way.
Well, we got about a minute and a half left, so give everybody a little bit of idea of maybe where you're at, how they can reach you or connect with you, talk with you, things like that.
Fine. I'm happy to do that. The best way to contact me is, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to communicate and talk to my readers. I'm everywhere that I can be in cyberspace because there's only one of me and I can only go physically to so many locations. But if you go to the website that we've referenced, the John Trudell, JohnTrudell.com, it leads you to many places. I have Facebook pages. I'm on LinkedIn. I have Twitter accounts. I have a blog. Everybody kept telling me, I have a publicist that kept saying, John, you have to do a blog. And I do. That's just blog, blog.johntrudell.com. And it has some actual fact stuff on there. And I even have guest people who contribute to it. It's a mix of stuff. There's a section on novels and fiction, but there's a section on nonfiction. There's a section on military. And as I do research for my novels, I run into people, spend a lot of time doing research, and they have serious, you know, hardcore things to say. And I go, oh, okay, can I put that up on my blog? And they say, sure. So you see some interesting things there. Like the Larry Bailey guy I talked about, we talked about Benghazi. Larry was also the lead guy that set up the veterans' protests on the so-called barricades back when the government was shut down. And that was an exciting week. A lot happened. So I try to communicate. I'm available in cyberspace, and I encourage everybody to look at my novels. You can contact me through the website or the blog. And I'm eager to get your inputs, and I ask you to take a look at my books and check them out.
Well, John, we want to thank you again so much for coming on. Wish you nothing but the best. Always fascinating to hear your insight and talk about your books. Kind of a little bit ahead of the game with your authoring, and it's always exciting to see. So, again, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate your interest and support, and let's do it again.
All right, we'll talk with you soon. Have a good year.
You too. Have a great year,
have a good year,
and have a very successful segment on this show.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author John Trudell with his book, Soft Target. Check out johntrudell.com for more information. Also, some other fabulous books that we have here from Simon & Schuster. It's called Case of Redemption. It is by author Adam Michener, who we thought was one of the best books of 2011 with his book out. So Dan Sorensen was once a high-powered New York defense attorney, but that was before a horrifying accident killed the two most important people in his life. As he approaches rock bottom, Dan is unexpectedly offered the opportunity of a lifetime. Defend an up-and-coming rapper who swears he's innocent of the brutal slaying of his pop star girlfriend. Dan realizes that this may be his only hope to put his own life back on track. But as he delves deeper into the case, he learns that atonement comes at a very steep price. Read A Case of Redemption by Adam Michener, available now in paperback and ebook wherever books are sold. The other thing that we want to do right now is we got contacted by a group that is doing a play. It's called Dial L for Latchkey. It's the radio play. It's a one-act play. It's a witty satire of the films of Alfred Hitchcock, written and directed by Scott Feivelson, and performed by the Time to Get to Tucson Players. By the Time I Get to Tucson Players. Never quite heard that before. The stage version has been produced in London and in San Francisco, and Dial L for Latchkey is available in as a paperback and an ebook from Hen House Press at Amazon.com, and now it's an audiobook digital from Blackstone Audio at Amazon. So we have a 3-minute or so clip here about this, and we're going to play it. And again, it's called Dial L. Here you go.
The By the Time I Get to Tucson Players present Dial L for Latchkey, a one-act play written and directed by Scott Feibelson.
Gee, you are completely relaxed. Empty your mind utterly, except for your breeding and good manners. It is the night Raymond tried to have you killed. Garrotted, to be specific.
Inspector.
You are asleep in bed. Raymond is off at a party. His flimsy alibi. Remember.
Marnie, you're aching my leg.
That's 1964. This is 1954, G. Get with it. The phone rings.
As if in a dream, G, in her mink coat over her striped prison uniform, wafts elegantly to the phone.
Don't answer it.
You answer it.
Hello?
Your husband, who knows you had an affair a year prior with a useless yank, and who stands to inherit your considerable fortune if you meet an untimely end, has timed it perfectly. Listening on the other end of the line, he doesn't say a word.
Hello?
And from behind the curtains, out steps death.
Bob is almost bug-eyed with looky-loo shock, impotence, guilt, as the man with the nylon stocking comes out from behind the curtains and begins to garrote G.
Inspector!
But in every perfect murder, there's always a little hitch.
A second figure emerges from behind the curtains to be known as the man who knew too much about Hitchcock. He is snappily dressed with a kind of frozen-in-time 1970s panache. Dark blazer, expensive open-neck shirt, very important, a silk neckerchief, big eyeglasses with big black frames, and jauntily full, gelled black hair.
Hitch knows that the last thing his audience expects is when Grace fights back like a little hellion.
While the film historian expounds ponderously on the periphery of the violence, G gropes wildly for a convenient scissors, grabs it, and stabs it into the back of her would-be killer.
It's the most exciting moment, probably the only one, in this most minor in the Hitch opera.
Then, bounding off the desk, stabs the film historian repeatedly in the chest, killing him too.
Ouch!
Stricken and shaking, G at least has the presence of mind to return to the phone.
Hello? Hello? I think you have the wrong number. Please check the number and dial again. How I do?
Very well indeed, madam.
Dial L for Latchkey, a one-act play. Available from Hen House Press at loveandpublishing.com.
So again, I want to welcome everybody back after the break and listening to that Dial L for Latchkey, and I want to thank John Trudell for being on the show with his last segment. We are going to jump right into here to our next guest. His name is Paul Parson. He has written now, this is his third book in his series, his Bowden Powell's Bead series, and this book is Axum. We talked to Paul not too long ago about his book London, and now he's back with another exciting installment. So, Paul, thanks so much for coming back on. How you doing?
Yeah, John, thanks for having me on. First show of the year. This is an honor.
Yeah, first show of the year, and it's great to be back. You know, we took a little time off, but, you know, we had the holidays. Things are always tough to get people around, so we're like, we're taking it off, and then we'll come back later.
Sure.
But, you know, something different that an author like yourself doesn't really have the luxury to do, especially when you have a lot of research that goes into a book that you write. You know, it's a little bit different than, you know, just kind of thinking of a murder mystery and putting them together and then, you know, having to figure it out. Your books are very, very in-depth research-wise. You do a lot of extensive research with them. I mean, they're very, very fascinating reads, especially for people into history or any of that kind of thing like that. So why don't you go ahead and give us the skinny here on book three now, Axum.
Sure. Thanks, John. The book three is called Baden-Powell's Beads, Axum. That's A-K-S-U-M. That's a city in northern Ethiopia that supposedly houses the true Ark of the Covenant. There's a lot of mystery surrounding that and whether it still exists and where it might exist, but there's a big celebration that occurs every year in Axum, Ethiopia, where they parade out this, probably not the true Ark that they have housed in a local church right there. But all the people go parade up and down the street behind this replica of the Ark, and the priests are involved, and it's a big deal. So, you know, who knows whether it's the real resting place of the Ark of the Covenant or not, but Axum, Ethiopia is steeped in history that goes back before recorded time. It was the center of civilization, essentially, thousands of years ago. And now it's not quite that, but it's still an interesting place to base a novel around. The first two books, the book started off as called Baden-Powell's Beads. Baden-Powell is a historic character. He's a real man, lived in the late 1800s, was a captain in the British Army in South Africa, fought in the Boer Wars. He found in South Africa this strand of Zulu beads that he put in his war chest and brought back to England with him. And 30 years later, Baden-Powell is the founder of our scouting movement. He founded the Boy Scouts, and he trained 19 scoutmasters in 1919, Gilwell Park in England, and gave them each one of these beads as a token for having completed this extra training as a scoutmaster, which is still an award given out to scoutmasters today. That's the premise of the story, is these beads that were found in South Africa, brought back to England and distributed, and eventually ended up in different places around the world, the original beads did. Well, it turns out these beads are very precious to the Zulu people. The original beads, four of them, were found 100 years later, and there was a big ceremony in South Africa, and they were given back to the granddaughter of the Zulu chieftain who lost them. That story is true, and that's what spurred my interest in creating a fictional tale around it. There was just too much good stuff. That was book one, with the Baden-Powell finding these beads, bringing them back to London, giving them to his scoutmasters, and the book opens in Memphis with a young doc who is given one of these beads by a dying patient, and he finds all hell breaks loose. The Zulus are after him in Memphis. They want his head. They want the beads. That grew into book two that we talked about in one of your other shows, where the protagonists end up in London researching the beads and following who wants them, who's willing to kill for them, and why. Then we end up in Axum, Ethiopia, and the trail for that is, as I research these beads, they're made out of acacia wood, which is a common wood in Africa. Well, according to the Book of Exodus in the Bible, so is the Ark of the Covenant. It's called shittim wood that Bezalel built the Ark of the Covenant out of. That connection was too good to pass up. We've got these real beads that really exist in South Africa that are now owned by who knows. And we have the Ark of the Covenant that may still exist in North Africa, made out of the same wood. I needed a way to connect them. And that is what happens over the four-book series, is there's a connection between these beads and the Ark of the Covenant. And who wants them and why? We end up in Ethiopia when the Arab terrorists get involved, and it turns out they're the people that are really behind the search for these beads and what they want to do with them. So our protagonists, the heroes in the book, are two Homeland Security agents who have, through multiple twists and turns, have gotten involved in following the trail of the beads. Along with the doctor who was given one of the beads and his girlfriend, who's a nurse, these four end up tangled up in this mess. the Homeland Security agents become bead holders themselves through twists and turns that happen in Book 2. So in Book 3, the why the beads have become important, why how they're connected to the history of mankind, why the Islamic terrorists want them, starts to reveal itself to the readers. As I was writing this, John, I didn't have an end point in mind. I didn't know where this series or where this story was going. I just followed the trail that history laid out for me and spun some interesting things around it and tried to build some interesting characters around it. And I think I did that. And I let it develop itself. I didn't start out with an outline. I didn't have an end point. I didn't know where the book was going. I didn't know where the story was going or how many books it would take to tell it. It turns out it took 4 books. As you mentioned earlier, the 4th book, which should be out in this summer, I hope, presently is called Wormwood, which if you're familiar with Nostradamus at all, that's the name of the asteroid that is supposed to hit Earth sometime in the future, predicted by him, and wipe out mankind or whatever. Well, the 4th book will not be called Wormwood, although that's on the website, that's still what it is. Publishers have a way of changing titles and things on you. So it will be eventually called Baden-Powell's Beads, Jerusalem, which is where the series ends. I say ends. It's where this story ends. Some of the characters will survive for future adventures, should the call be out there for that.
Right.
So that's in a nutshell. That's where we are today. Book 3 came out. Baden-Powell's Beads, Axum came out 3 weeks ago. It's gotten good reviews. Its early sales are good. I have a book signing this afternoon.
Good.
Local bookstores, Mysteries and More, here in Nashville. A great independent bookstore, very supportive of local writers. So we're looking for a good turnout at that and a good kickoff to Book 3.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, it's very exciting when you get involved, you know, with your books and you start reading about the mystery, because I like when you mentioned that you didn't even know where it was going to go, that you just kind of let it flow from the beginning and you didn't even know it was going to kind of be 4 books, that the story just kind of happened as you did it and kind of morphed itself into this organically. And I think that if you would have tried to maybe go and outline and try to get it down, I think you might have missed something. I think it would have missed the passion maybe that, you know, you've been able to put into your books and have the story kind of, you know, unfold as it is. And now, like you said, with the 3rd book, Axum, you see a lot more things kind of revealed with the bees and kind of how they've, you know, the importance of them and how they kind of are going to affect things. So I find that very exciting and fascinating that, you know, that's kind of how your process works.
Yeah, it is a novel. It is fiction, but it's based in so much history and so many real events and people that it makes it wonder, makes the reader wonder a little bit. Well, could it? You know, is that really? Is that what's really going on? Could it happen? And I mix in a lot of, especially in Book 4, a lot of more biblical history, Nostradamus predictions, things that are part of our current lexicon or current understanding. And weave it into this tale, which was fun for me. And like you said, I didn't know where it was going, so it wasn't forced. I find that if I shoot for a target, you know, if I want something to happen, then I contort characters' actions, dialogue, and make it almost starts to sound artificial to me. If I can surprise myself using the facts and the writing. As I write it, then I figure the reader will be surprised also. In fact, I'm playing with the idea, the whole series, the whole 4 books and the story ends, it surprised me when I wrote it. I had no idea it was going to end that way. To the point where if the readers, after reading book 1, 2, and 3, if they can figure out basically the ending and what happens to one of our characters, I'll give them the set. I mean, it's sort of if you want to have a contest announced on your show, there are four people in the world that know how it ends, that have read the manuscripts. They're disqualified. Anybody else that can figure
and
out
and their friends and family are disqualified too. They can't tell people how it ends.
Yeah, that's right. So if they can figure it out, if the readers can figure out where this is going, you know, more power to them. That'd be I'd love to have a dialogue with the readers over the next year through my website or email address to get their ideas where they think it's going. As an aside, the story is a living thing until you print it, you know, until it's actually in book form. It evolves. My editor, Jessica Leda, L-A-D-A, who I was blessed to get to have an association with, came back after reading the first two books and doing them and reading the third book. She said, I had two of the main characters, the principal guy, Patrick Dartson, a Homeland Security agent, and the principal female lead, Pam Blanchard, who's a nurse with, turns out, some special ops training. I had them in a flirtatious, platonic relationship throughout the series. They never really got together, but they're attractive, they're young, they're healthy, they're energetic, and my editor came back after getting through with book three, and she said, Paul, that's not going to work. I'm sorry. You got to hook these two up. There's too much. So I did. I had to go back in book three and change it, not change the ending or the real story. But she was right. I mean, she always is. I had to let the relationship develop like it would in normal life. Well, now, John, I got book four. It's already in the can. It's written. But I have to go back and flavor the whole thing with now a romantic involvement between the two principals rather than just this flirtatious, platonic type thing. So I got some work to do left on book four. So if I hear from the readers something that's too good to pass up, I mean, it'll find its way into the book.
Well, you know, people can find you at pauldparsons.com for a lot more information, and you have, of course, all the places where they can, you know, email you sample chapters, things like that. You can find the books everywhere. So there's definitely no excuse for them not to be able to find out exactly where you're at and what you're doing. And, yeah, so Paul D. Parsons is the site. Now, in the book, did you introduce anybody kind of new to the reader and ask them a new character that kind of came out of nowhere that almost, like, you know, surprised you within the series?
Yes. There's a... the villain in book one is the antagonist is a Zulu warrior. In book two, it's the contact with the Arab or the Islamic world. In book three, we meet the principal, the main antagonist who is behind the search for the beads, that has a purpose, that has an intent. His name is called Lij Mirad, which is two words, L-I-J, and then the last is M-E-R-E-D. He's the force behind this. He's the driving entity that wants to gather all of the original 24 beads and use them for his nefarious purposes. Funny story about him. He had my first writing, which was when I did this several years ago. He was not named Lij Mirad. He had another name. And just before I sent the book off for publication, I thought, okay, one last pass through. Let me check the history, the names, everybody. Well, his original name was just a little bit too close to somebody who is still with us and important in Ethiopia. I thought, no, that's not going to work. So I had to go back and, because he is a totally fictional character, and I had to make sure the readers understood, even in Ethiopia, if they're reading out there, that this is a totally fictional character. So,
right.
It's a little bit of a problem with weaving history into novel. There are a lot of very intelligent readers out there who can pick you apart if they choose to do so. For instance,
but that's also a good thing. I mean, that's also a really good thing that you have, you know, extremely intelligent readers, because that makes you a better author. It makes you have to be better. It makes you work at your craft just that much harder to make sure that you get things done correctly. And I think that you would appreciate that, you know, especially, you know, when readers, even if they do kind of, you know, say, you know, this is wrong or this is wrong, at least you know that they're paying a lot of attention and that they care. And I think that that's important, too.
Yeah, that's the what I like to read are entertaining novels that I learn something about history from. Now, if I really want to get into it, then I'll go back and look it up in, you know, historically correct writings. But I learn a lot of history through people like Wilbur Smith, James Michener, and reading their novels, picking up on little tidbits of history. And that's what I like to write. You have to make a choice, though, sometimes, John. There's, for instance, at the beginning of this book, the series, I had to choose to be true to either the date Baden-Powell found the beads or to the dates of the actual official Boer War that was taking place in South Africa. I had to do one or the other. And I decided in the long run, the interest in the reader would be more along the lines of Baden-Powell and the beads. So I chose the date of 1888, which is when he found the beads in South Africa, and had it happen in a battle between Baden-Powell and the Zulus, which may have been going on at the time, but it wasn't an official part of the Boer War, which there were two of them. One was right before that date, and one was right after that date. That doesn't slip by all the readers. Some of them pick up on the people that are really versed in history notice that, wait a minute, the Boer War didn't start back then. But that's a choice I made. I had to choose what I want to
do,
what's important.
Yeah, sometimes you have to do something,
yeah.
Yeah.
It
I mean,
is fiction, after all.
You're not writing a history book. You're writing a fiction book. And sometimes
things have
to get stretched a little bit. And,
right.
Yeah. Now, do you explain kind of in the back or throughout, you kind of say, hey, you know, this is based off of true events, just maybe not in the right timeline, but, you know, things that you see in here have happened in the world and things like that. You kind of give that little disclaimer?
Yes, I do have a disclaimer in the front of the book, and in the back of the book, I have a fact versus fiction page
right.
in each book so that the reader can sort out, if they're interested, where what the actual facts were and what were some of the fabrications related to those that I made up.
Yeah, and I think that that's big important also for readers to kind of understand, hey, you know, this is, like I said, you know, this is based off of true events, but, you know, it's not, so yeah. And that's what you always get stuck at. You know, whenever you are a, historical fiction writer, you know, you have to deal with a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of those things you got to deal with. When you're writing a book like this.
Yeah, and history, you find out, is kind of fluid. I mean, Michener wrote his book on Poland, and it was history from his perspective, but he got banned from Poland for years. He couldn't go back to that country because of their interpretation of what he'd written. He wrote another book where he had to invent a state within the United States. It was a fictional state in order to tell this story. He was so cautious about not wanting to mislead readers with it. So you do have to invent things to tell a historical fiction and make it entertaining. You do have to decide, are you a storyteller or are you a history writer? And I consider myself a storyteller.
So now what's your goals for 2014? I mean, what's one of the things that you're hoping to accomplish? What's one of the, you know, maybe bucket list or resolution things that you kind of put on your plate this year?
Sure. The big thing is to get this story told and out there, get the book 4 done, hopefully get it out for the summer reading group. Then, really shooting for the moon, this is a 4-book series that follows the same characters through the same story with different villains. It's set up for screenplays and for movies. So later in the year, what I'd like to do is box the set and then work that angle of it. is get it turned into a screenplay or work the movie end of it. And I've got a few connections along those lines, and maybe can pull that off.
Well, now that would be very exciting if you can get that going. You know, Hollywood needs some new things to go on. I mean, some of the stuff that's coming out, I mean, it's rehashing the old and rehashing the same old things that have been out there. And I'm tired of all the remakes of movies.
Right.
Seems like that's all they know how to do now. So,
yeah, or taking cartoon characters.
People,
yeah.
Yeah, and I live in Los Angeles, and I work close to, you know, where the CAA building is, you know, William Morris Agency. And I hear and I talk to people, and I'm like, with all the great work that's out there in literature and everything else, why do they keep making another freaking story that's already been told? Why are they rehashing the same thing? I don't understand it. I don't get it. So, you know, I hope nothing but the best. I wish you nothing but the best. So hopefully that would happen, because it would be nice and refreshing to see something new and talented on the screen, whether it's TV or whether it's movie. It doesn't really make a difference. I always think TV can tell a story better than movie, but that's just me. So, yeah.
Sure. No, I'll go along whichever route that – it would be exciting. We've made some movie trailers for it that we showed in local theaters, and these are trailers. They're available on the website. I mean, we had actors, lighting crews, sound crews. I mean, this isn't just your usual, you know, 15-second trailer. And it was fun.
Yeah.
And it was fun to watch it develop on screen. I'd love to see it happen in a big way.
Yeah, and people don't realize that 2-minute trailer probably took 8 hours to do.
Oh, no, 2 weeks. Yeah, it's two weeks.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean,
with everything involved.
Just the filming, yeah, but then once you do the editing and everything else, oh, it's such an extensive process that I don't think a lot of people understand just how long it is. I mean, you're sitting 8 hours trying to get 2 minutes correct, then you have to go edit it, and then you got to put the music over it, you got to do the whole other stuff. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it takes forever for movies to come out. You know,
that's
they can
right.
film them in a month, but then that's just where the fun begins.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned that
well,
doing these trailers. So.
Yeah, I mean, so we got about a minute and a half left. And again, I wanted to let you kind of, you know, have the last word on, you know, maybe where you're going to be, where people can get a hold of you and things like that. So, you know, go right ahead.
Well, I am based in Nashville and well-known in this area, and travel around to different groups talking about the books and bookstores, et cetera, here. But am open to appearing before groups elsewhere. I've been in Dallas. I've been on the West Coast. I've been up in New York. I'm developing an audience is something I'm not going to skimp on. So if there's interest elsewhere, I can be reached through the website, which is my name, Paul D. Parsons, PaulDParsons.com. My Facebook link is on there. There's a Facebook link for the book, which is called Baden Powell's Beads Series. It's a Facebook page that I can be contacted through, and people can keep up with the books on. So I'm open and available. If it'll help develop the book and develop the story and get it out there, let me know.
All right. Well, Paul, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and see all the new stuff that you got coming out. And we can't wait for book 4 to be out. Again, it's going to be called Jerusalem. So if people go on the website and they see Wormwind, that book is going to change. And it's going to be called Jerusalem. So
that's right.
Just so people might not get confused. Well, Paul, thanks again for coming on. And, you know, wishing nothing but the best. Can't wait to see what's going on in the future. And we will talk with you soon.
Thank you, John.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Paul D. Parsons. And you can go to pauldparsons.com for a lot more information to see exactly what's going on here in the Baden-Powell's Beads series. With his latest book, Axum, with the third book in the series. So we are going to be back now with our next guest, author M.L. Rowland. The book is called Zero Degree Murder. It's the first in a series. It's a search and rescue mystery series. So we're very excited to talk to M.L. about this book, and we'll be right back in just a couple minutes, right after we play this. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, here after the break. We are now into our second segment of the show, First Hours Pass, with John Trudeau and Paul D. Parsons. And we are excited to have, like we mentioned, debut author M.L. Rowland with her first book ever called Zero Degree Murder, and it's actually the first in a series, and it's taglined a search and rescue mystery book. So, M.L., we want to thank you so much for coming on today, and how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and thank you very much for having me.
And like I said off the air, I love talking to debut authors because the journey is always so fascinating. So give us the inside information now into your first book, Zero Degree Murder.
Well, the inside information is that I spent about a dozen years as a very active volunteer on a very active search and rescue team in Southern California, and I had written a number of things throughout the years, nonfiction, magazine articles, actually a number of screenplays, and I decided to try my hand at fiction because I am a mystery novel lover, and decided to write what I know, which is the advice that you always hear. And so since I knew search and rescue, I thought I would write a mystery about search and rescue. So the book series is about, well, features Gracie Kincaid, who is a single woman in her mid-30s who is a volunteer on a search and rescue team in the mountains of Southern California.
And, you know, you've done a lot of extensive things, you know, when people go to your website, and again, that is mlrowland.com, R-O-W-L-A-N-D. And they click on your bio, I mean, they're going to see that you've done a lot of extensive, you know, search and rescue. I mean, you got some fascinating pictures up there of where you've been. So what kind of cases or things, you know, of course, there's always some really great search and rescue things across, you know, history that we've been able to find out. But what kind of things have you come across that enabled you to say, hey, this is kind of the time that I want to start writing and that I want to kind of have my character, you know, Gracie Kincaid out there?
Right. Well, actually, I did very little traditional research for Zero Degree Murder because I was able to draw on my own experience and the experiences of other teammates. I could put a lot of that into the book. I actually had a certification by the state of California in tracking. So Gracie does quite a bit of tracking in the book. Because I lived in that area that is described in the book, the little town, the mountains, the wilderness area, that's all from my own experience. And I'll give you a little bit of idea, just an introduction to the book, and then I will try to remember to circle back around and bring that into this question. But
okay.
In the book, Gracie responds to a call out on Thanksgiving Day, which actually happens a lot. You get called out a lot on holidays, for a group of missing hikers that are a movie cast and crew, which includes the hot British movie star Rob Christian. So when Gracie hits the trail with her teammate, Steve Cashman, it's already dark, and things begin to go downhill when the tracks that Gracie and Steve are following, it leads them down into a very deep, very steep canyon where they find Rob, who is injured and hypothermic. Well, this whole scenario of leaving the trail to go down into this canyon was based on an actual search that I did where two women in the mountains of Southern California were picking ferns, and I can't remember if it was for soup or what it was, but it was a specific kind of fern that could only be found in this specific area. They went off over the side, and it was a very steep, rugged canyon. They hiked down, and then I don't really remember whether they got lost or they couldn't hike out, but they turned up missing. And so my teammates, it was two men and I, went down into this canyon to look for them, and it was so steep that we had no GPS reading. There was no cell phone coverage,
oh.
Although at that time there wasn't, you know, cell phones weren't as prevalent. So then we eventually found these women in a very similar manner that Gracie and Steve Cashman find Rob, that we were calling and blowing whistles, and we finally heard them, and they heard us, and we found them at the bottom of the canyon. They were very severely hypothermic, and they probably would have not lasted the night. That's an actual search that turns up, you know, those circumstances turn up in this book.
You know, and a lot of people that have never visited Southern California and have just, I guess, seen it on TV or, you know, seen whatever, they don't realize how many mountains and trails and wilderness that there really is because, you know,
yeah.
We live here in Southern California, and I mean, the mountains around and the trails and everything, you always hear, there's always sometime, it seems like all the time, you hear of a hiker getting lost
yeah.
or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the time. Yeah,
right.
And people don't realize that that's very dangerous around here. You just don't go walking out with your little backpack saying, oh, let's go explore this. No,
right.
You
it's
don't.
It's very rugged.
Yeah. So I think it's great that you're kind of, because, I mean, what it kind of does, I think, is, you know, you're bringing some good awareness also to saying, hey, you know what, people, you know, it's, this stuff happens, and if you're thinking about doing something, why don't you, like, do a little research and make sure that you can do it?
Yeah, Yeah. Well, you know, that's really good advice, but people don't always take that advice.
Right.
So, well, and interestingly, go ahead.
You go right ahead. I was done.
Okay. Well, interestingly enough, what people do nowadays, I have found, is they have their navigation system on their car. And they think, oh, well, I'm just going to turn this on and it's going to take me where I want to go. Well, those systems are not infallible. Or they will go out on a hike and bring only their cell phone and say, oh, well, if I get lost, I'll just call. Well, these are very steep, very rugged mountains, and this actually takes place in the San Bernardino Mountains, and so your cell phone doesn't always have reception, and so you still need to know where you are, and even if you get lost or injured.
Yeah, cell phone towers in the middle of the San Bernardino Mountains. They're just not doing it.
Yeah.
I mean.
No. Yeah. Yeah, so even at that time, which was about 10 years ago, less than 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, people still just went out with a cell phone and said, that's all I need. I don't need a map. I don't need where I'm going. I can take this little bottle of water with me, and I'm fine. So, I've been asked a lot this week because of the cold weather out east. Well, what do you say to people? What do you say to people that get stranded in their car when it's really cold? Or, what kind of survival tips do you give people? And I say the best advice that I can give to anybody in those situations, or when you're going out for a walk, or when you're going out in your car, is do your homework or do your preparation before you even leave. Bring adequate water with you. Bring layers. If you don't want to wear them, then bring them in a pack on your back. Know where you're going. Look at a map, and so you know where you're going. Because even if you can call out, you still need to let rescuers know where you are. We actually had a situation where I was a maybe three men, I can't remember. They came up from the Los Angeles area up into the mountains, into the snow. I think they got stuck in their vehicle. But anyway, they called in to Search and Rescue and told Search and Rescue where to go. Well, when Search and Rescue got there, there was nobody there because they had given them the wrong location. And so if you don't know where you are, even, if you can call out, you still need to be able to tell people where you are. So.
Yeah. You can't just say, I'm stuck by the big rock. That's not going to help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or this tree or whatever, because there's thousands of acres there. So
so now, when you have the book here, Zero Degree Murder, again, this is the first in the series, and you kind of wrote it, it's not really more along the lines of a whodunit. I mean, it's pretty much a suspense kind of thriller because there's some fast-paced things going on, but you also have the suspense of figuring out what's happening and trying to figure out why this thing kind of, like you said, kind of from routine to deadly. The mission quickly goes from routine to deadly fast.
Yeah.
When you were kind of going through, and you're kind of writing something like this, what was the one thing that you wanted to make sure that you relayed to the readers? How did you kind of want them to make sure that when you were taking them through this, this labyrinth of words and everything you have on there, what's the one thing you wanted to make sure they got?
One of the most important things I think about this whole series is that Gracie, who doesn't think she's very strong, is a lot stronger than she thinks. And Gracie is actually somewhat an amplification of my own personality. I've taken bits of my personality, put her into Gracie. I've taken bits of other personalities and put her into Gracie. But it's this determination to not give up, and also one of the most really predominant characteristics of rescuers, and I'm talking about the rescue field, search and rescue, EMS personnel, firefighters, law enforcement, is to save the person that's at risk. And so one of the things that I really focused on was this terror almost that Gracie feels that Rob Christian is in her care, basically, and that he might die. In other words, she might not be able to save him. And so I was trying to build the, it was actually kind of difficult for me to write. This book went through many manifestations because I wanted to make it sort of on the edge suspense, but I also wanted to make it a bit of a whodunit for Gracie trying to figure out who this was and who was trying to kill Rob and why. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, because what you're doing is, you know, like I said, you're kind of, it's a mystery on the fact of, they don't really, you know, the reader's not going to know what's going on until you kind of reveal it to them later in the end. It's not like, you know, they kind of,
right.
You know, they know the bad guy or the, and this and that, and it's just like a cat and mouse back and forth, and, you know, you're changing
right.
the chapters and this and that. So
right.
I always kind of find, you know, those types of things more fascinating than kind of knowing everything at the beginning, because then it kind of, I don't know, it kind of has a little lack of punch. Well, I like it more
yeah.
along the lines where I don't know, and then all of a sudden it's like in my face, like, wow, I didn't see that one coming, and that's what I like to know. You know, I think that's what a lot of fans like to know. Yeah. And so
right.
it sounds like that's the kind of books that you were reading a lot of before you decided to write.
Well, I actually read a lot of everything. I mean, I love mysteries. I tend to read all books. But if I find an author that I really like, I tend to read all of that author's books. But I've read thrillers, I read mysteries, I read, you know, dramas, historical fiction, and so I kind of wrote where my gut went rather than to stay within one formula for one genre. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get you.
So
yeah, you kind of get a little taste of many different things and kind of how many different authors do their own kind of work, regardless of the genre. You can kind of still get a taste for how they piece a story together.
Right, right. Yeah, and actually, I mean, my attention span is very short. That's probably why, you know, I was on Search and Rescue, because it's always interesting. And it was every single search was different because the circumstances, the victims, the season, the terrain, the personnel responding, everything was different. So every single search was different. And so I like to write in a not only a way that keeps me interested, obviously, but that keeps the reader interested, and with a lot of different things going on, and just a lot of things happening.
Yeah, and
the
one good thing is that, you know, you had some time to write this because it's your first one, so you can get
yeah.
it right. You can make sure you know, because there's no rush when you're doing the first one. You got to make sure that this is what it is. And a lot of people say, oh, the first book was the toughest to write. I always disagree and say I think the first book was the easiest to write, just for the simple fact you had so much time to do it.
True.
You could get it done. After that
True.
Is when it gets tough, because now your publisher's like, I need one in 6 months. And you're like,
yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm facing that
right
now.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
See?
Well, interesting.
Yeah, and so, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, interestingly enough, This first book was very difficult for me to write because I had been writing screenplays. And a screenplay was like, or is like, I look at it, I'm very big on imagery, and that's kind of the way I write, but it's like a skeleton of the story, and you can only write what can be seen or heard on the screen. So then when I decided to go into fiction or prose, I had to learn how to put the meat on the skeleton. And it was very difficult. It was difficult for me. It was a difficult transition. It was a real challenge. And, I mean, it's not one that I wasn't doing willingly, obviously. But so I really actually rewrote this book probably more than 10 times, a complete rewrite, to get it right. And every time I rewrote it, I learned something new.
Something new,
Yeah, about my writing, about my voice, about what works, about plotting, about character, about dialogue. And so the next one, which actually I have book two, which is called Murder Off the Beaten Path, which comes out in October, that book, I actually had bits and pieces of it already written because I was writing that aspect of search and rescue, which is technical ropes rescue, as I was doing technical ropes. I would make notes. So a lot of that was already written. And so when I wrote that draft, I could just pull from my notes and say, well, I'm glad I really wrote all this down because all this detail is right here. So for me, it was the first book was very difficult. The second book was easier, and then now I'm starting to plot and work on book three, and it's the process is easier for me because I've gone through that really 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 steep learning curve on the first book. So.
And I want to remind everybody to go to mlroland.com for a lot more information to find out more about the book Zero Degree Murder, which just came out January the 7th. So it's out now. So when everybody listens to the show, they can go buy the book, ebook, or print, whichever you know they prefer. So I guess the only thing is like a debut author. We do have a lot of authors that always listen to the show, or people that are aspiring to be authors, and they always like to know the thing. Give us a little bit about like your journey on when you finished it, and now you want to get it published. What did you do?
I sent out a ton of query letters to agents, to publishers, to editors, and I went through a lot of rejections. It was difficult. This is not an easy process, especially with the way the publishing industry is now. It's just not an easy process. And so one of the most I'm asked often, what advice would you give somebody out there? And there's a couple of different things that I would say. Is the first thing is don't stop living your life in order to write, because your life experience gives you perspective, it gives you great characters, it gives you great plot ideas, but also don't give up. If you get a rejection from an editor or an agent or something, say, okay, why did I get this rejection letter? I also think it's very important to constantly have your work critiqued from people that are really interested in helping you learn. Because that way, if you write in a vacuum, you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to learn what you're doing wrong or badly, if you will, but you're also not going to learn what you're doing well and what you're doing right. So I think getting critique from friends who are knowledgeable or a writer's group or, you know, online groups or whatever, I think that's very important. It's also very important just to keep learning about the craft of writing. So, I mean, there's lots of different things that you can do. But I think one of the most important things is don't give up. Keep trying. Don't give up.
And so the thing is that if you would have not received, let's say you went on for a couple months later and you just didn't get anything from agents or publishers, would you have decided, you know what, I'm just going to do it myself, and I'm going to put it on Amazon KDP, and I'm just Kindle, and I'm just going to do it myself?
Yes. The answer, yes, because I was actually at that point. Because
oh.
I had been querying a lot, and I had started investigating e-publishing. I had gone back and forth and back and forth on that because I had read somewhere that once you e-publish, then an agent is not going to look at it. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I think
that's
that may vary,
true.
Of course.
That's not true at all. That's a lie.
Okay. Well, I think that I probably thought at the time that was somebody's opinion, and I didn't know whether it was true or not.
Yeah, no.
So I think go for it. I mean, that is an avenue that's out there and it's available to writers, and I think it's a great thing. It's not that expensive to do it, at least just to get it out there. So I think go for it.
Well, ML, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always, like I said, it's fascinating to hear the stories of a debut author, and, you know, one that is very unique, which is the search and rescue mystery, because I can't think of anything off the top of my head where it would, you know, you would kind of be the same. I've never heard of a character kind of in this kind of same realm, so I like it when it's unique. The one thing that I do notice when I was on Amazon here, when you were talking, I was looking, and it seems like a lot of people kind of put you in the cozy category, but I don't believe that this is more of a cozy book. This is more of a suspense thriller that people that think that,
I agree.
You know, yeah, if you're a cozy reader, I don't think that this is for, you know, maybe this is not for you, but if you're a suspense thriller reader and you like fast-paced, you like action, this is for you. So sometimes you have to filter through those things and see. The biggest thing is to know that it's not a cozy. There's blood on the cover. And when there's blood on the cover, it ain't cozy, people.
Right, I agree.
I'm not, right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it was originally named a cozy because I wouldn't have listed it as a cozy.
I think it's because because your publisher is Berkeley, and they're big for that. So yeah.
Ah, okay. All right. Yeah,
so.
I would say suspense thriller. I mean, there's sort of that crossover thing. It's kind of a blurred line,
yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of action and it's very fast paced.
Yeah. Well, again, ML, we want to thank you again so much for coming on. Wish you nothing but the best. And
thank you.
We'd love to see what happens with you in the future, so stay in touch.
All right. Thank you so much for asking me. It was my pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author ML Rowland, debut author with her book, Zero Degree Murder, the first in a new series of search and rescue mystery. Check out mlrowland.com for a lot more information. We are going to be back here now with our last segment, New York Times, number one New York Times bestselling author, Lisa Gardner, a friend of ours, for her latest book, Fear Nothing. Let me tell you, I'm a slow reader, and I read this thing in 2 days. And that's what you're going to get with this book because, I'm going to tell you, you're just going to learn about a new character of hers called Melvin, and you're going to love it. And I'm going to let Lisa tell you about that. So we'll see you guys in just a second. We'll be right back.
So we want to welcome you all back there after the break here for our last segment on, and we want to welcome our good friend and author here, new number one New York Times bestselling author, Lisa Gardner, with her latest book, Fear Nothing, the latest in the D.B. Warren detective series, which, of course, if you haven't read one of them, I don't know where you've been. So, Lisa, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
Just fine, John. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
It is. I know that you're out and about right now doing some book promotion for it, and I'm glad that you're able to have a little time to stop with us and talk with us about Fear Nothing. Like I said off the air, you know, on the air right before you came on, I read this book in 2 days. I don't read a book in 2 days. I'm just not a fast reader. But for some reason, I couldn't put this down. And I know, and I was trying to pinpoint, you know, what it was about it. And the thing that it was about it for me was I had to see what the next word was, and I had to keep going on and on to just see what the next word was going to be, because I was just so enthralled with that. And I don't know if that's maybe the thing about it, but tell us a little bit about Fear Nothing and kind of how it is, because this is a book about pain, without a doubt.
Yes.
That's what this is wrapped around.
This is a book about pain, and this is a book about family, and I think many listeners will agree that sometimes those two things are the same. So
yes, they are, especially with the holidays that just passed.
Exactly. So this is a tale of two sisters. They are both survivors of a serial killer father. After his death, one is turned loose in the foster system, and by the age of 14, she herself is one of the most notorious killers in Massachusetts and continues to commit murder even while incarcerated for life. Then there's the younger sister, the quote-unquote good sister, Dr. Adeline Glenn. She is adopted into a loving family. She builds a very respected, well-educated, well-adjusted life. When a string of murders start happening that imitate their late father's work, they end up needing to join forces and working with Detective D.D. Warren to try to catch a killer.
Yeah, and That's the one big twist that, you know, kind of is in the thing, because it is kind of based off of the killings of the infamous serial killer dad, Harry Day. The killer's kind of imitating, or are they imitating? And it's like,
yeah,
how close to home does these things go? And you've been able, and like I said, I mean, the book is wrapped around pain, because you got one person that can't feel it. You got one person that just is immensely involved in it, and then you have Dee Dee, which is now feeling it physically, and has to name it. And that's just one of the funny, and that's what I tell people, you're going to learn about Melvin, and
yes,
that's one of the things that just makes it so exciting to read, is just all the things that you've wrapped up into this one.
Well, all of my books have a piece that's ripped from the headlines. And in the case of Fear Nothing, I read an article about a very real-world condition. It's extremely rare, but it's called congenital insensitivity to pain. And it's children that are born with a genetic defect, frankly, where they have no ability at all to feel any kind of pain. I have to say, as a middle-aged woman, that sounded awesome. I'm at that phase of life where, you know, I have way more aches and pains than I would like. I'm like, yes. But the younger sister, Dr. Adeline Glenn, is born with this condition. And one of the first things she starts to realize after her older sister, frankly, takes a pair of scissors to her, is you need pain. It's what keeps you alive. It's what keeps you safe. And in fact, in the real world, the majority of kids born with this condition will die before the age of 3. And
yeah,
that really becomes one of the themes of the book. At the very beginning, Detective Dee Dee Warren suffers this terrible on-the-job injury when she is ambushed. She's on medical leave. She could not lift her gun. She could not lift her child. She's pretty angry about the whole thing. She's sent to see this pain therapist, Dr. Adeline Glenn, who's trying to tell her to embrace her pain, love your pain, name your pain. And Dee Dee uses words I can't use on the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was pretty pissed, let's just say, throughout the book,
yeah,
on Melvin, which she had the name. But yeah, it was, I had heard about that condition of not being able to feel pain. But what you did fabulously was being able to talk about how someone has to live with it and what they almost have to do, like, every hour of the day to check,
yeah,
themselves.
Well, and one of the things that really captured me about this condition when I was reading this article about this young girl with it is, what is the psychological impact of this?
Right.
I mean, Dr. Adeline Glenn isn't just someone who's having to go through life, like you said, on almost an hourly basis, having to do a full physical check because she can't know if she's cut herself. She doesn't know if she's right now running a fever because she has an infection. She has to constantly check and check and check. But it's even more, I mean, pain is kind of one of those fundamental shared human experiences. It's what gives us empathy. It's what gives us compassion. If you've never felt it, how do you bond and relate to the whole rest of the world? Or I think more, Adeline's whole point is everyone in the world knows something she doesn't. I mean, she is forever the outsider in the room, and that's hard. That is hard to take.
Yeah, because even though Adeline can't feel the physical pain, the one thing that you did very well in constructing this character, too, was she feels a ton of mental pain. And, you know, she's a doctor of psychology, in psychiatry. It's not a, not like a medical, you know, doctor. So that's the one thing. So she not only has to endure the pain of all of her patients, but now you put her in this situation to where, you know, her father was the serial killer, and then her sister is involved in, you know, incarcerating at 14 years old and with everything that she's been having to do. And she's had to live through all of that. And
yes,
then she has to work with Shauna.
Yeah. She's obsessed with pain. I mean, it's like it's the one thing she can't feel. So she's built an entire life about, like you said, about pain. And in particular, spends one day a month visiting her, you know, incarcerated sister, even though her very own adoptive father was like, what are you, nuts? I mean, this woman's a killer. You were lucky you got away from her. Why would you willingly want a relationship with this kind of sibling? But again, you know, as Adeline says, maybe when you can't feel pain, you're somewhat doomed to forever seek it out. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's the ultimate thing you'll never know.
You can, it's kind of the one thing that you can never touch, smell, or sensate, but you just want to try to experience it in some way. And her sister, Shauna, And I'll tell you what, her sister, Shauna, when people say that they have ice water running through their veins, Shauna has dry ice running through her veins.
Yeah.
That's the kind of cold, calculated sister that you've created here with like a perfect spinoff of her father, Harry Day, but even amped up to just a different degree. How was that creation for Shauna?
She's absolutely one of the most frightening characters I've ever done. But one of the things I loved about her is as the book evolves and these two sisters are forced to work together, and to a certain extent, because this is really, this killer seems to have something to do with their father, talk for the first time in 40 years about this household they grew up in that was, as you can imagine, a deeply disturbing place. That is what bonds siblings. I mean, at the end of the day, siblings are kind of the shared memory of the parents, and, you know, you kind of join together at a certain point against your parents, and they start to really feel that bond and connection. And it's when you start to see the kind of humanness in Shauna, and it's always that question mark. Is she using her sister? Is she manipulating this entire situation? Or is she really lonely too? And that's the fundamental question that, you know, both Dee Dee and Adeline worry about all the time.
Yeah. I mean, halfway, about third of the way through, you start to see Shauna starting to show a little bit more emotion than just, you know, ice cubes. And then I started wondering, okay, there's an agenda going on here because there's no way. There's something going on. And that's what the thing about it is that I just found it. I mean, I found it fascinating. I mean, she was one of the only women characters I've ever read that, I mean, she really did scare me that if there was somebody like that out there, I would probably be scared to even talk with them, even for an interview for the magazine or whatever.
What I think was so scary and gives you one of the senses of dread that I hope keeps people reading the book is, you know, Adeline, this younger sister, she is a psychiatrist. She is a professional. She has no illusions to just that her sister's a psychopath. I mean, she's incapable of feeling emotion. And yet, they seem to have this emotional connection. So it's at the one hand, she knows she's dancing with a cobra, but on the other hand, she can't stop doing it.
Yes.
And it is that, how is this going to work out? But it's that awareness at all times that this is really not a good idea, but I just can't stop coming back. And I think all of us have that kind of relationship sometime in our life where it's like, I shouldn't be doing this, and yet here I am, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it almost is like in this book, Dee Dee kind of takes just a little back seat to the sisters and how all the interaction kind of goes, because it is so dynamic between how they have to work and the thing they have to do. And remember, and there's still a killer going on, copycatting what their father did. I mean, almost to the T, copycatting.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because Dee Dee Warren, who's such an aggressive cop, she is almost the voice of reason in this book. She's almost the one that's more like, whoa, this is a stupid way of going about this. I can catch this killer. We don't need to be working with a woman who's already killed, you know, five other people. You know, leave the crazy woman alone. And, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you had to kind of transform Dee Dee into something like that. So when you were sitting down and, you know, when you had the idea and you started putting everything together and started working it out, when was that kind of thing that you decided, you know what, I do maybe have to change how Dee Dee works a little bit in this book, not just because of the pain, but just because of the, you know, the sisters involved within the crime?
You know, my goal when I wrote Fear Nothing, because I'm bringing Detective Dee Dee Warren back, is to give her a challenge. I think readers will agree Dee Dee can do anything on the professional front. I mean, she's so confident in her skills as a homicide detective, and she's also just so legitimately jazzed. I mean, there's nothing she likes better than a good murder investigation.
Yeah.
So to injure her, to take her off the job, to have her in a situation where she can't dress herself. I mean, she's lost total use of her left arm. I mean, she's completely at, you know, she has to wait for her husband to come home if she wants to wash her hair. She can't lift her gun. She can't raise her child. I mean, this is a whole new Dee Dee Warren. And in the beginning, she's so angry about it. But then there is this kind of, that's getting her nowhere. And, you know, rage is one of the emotions she does best, but it doesn't solve the problem. So it is forcing her to actually kind of take the next logical step of, okay, I might actually have to accept something for once in my life. And I might have, you know, it's I think it's called growing up a little, you know.
Right.
You know.
I mean, what it is, I mean, you basically have to have taken deep, I mean, and you've just made her that much more complex with different feelings and things that she's never had to experience before. And in turn, that means you as the author have never had to have to experience them before in writing them with her. So that has been another great challenge.
It's maturity for all of us. You know, you go through life and things happen that you didn't expect, and you can, you know, be enraged about it and bitter about it, or you can adapt to it. And adaptability, I would never say is one of Dee Dee's strong suits, but she's at a phase in her life if she's going to really juggle, you know, a family, a child, and a really challenging job, adaptability is what it's going to take. And it's interesting, some of my favorite scenes are her and Dr. Adeline Glenn talking about one of the big secrets, and this is true, this is actually from real life again, to minimizing physical pain is actually the mental acceptance of it. And there's a million scientific studies out there that will tell you, you don't need to change your physical condition, you just need to mentally accept it, and your pain will almost immediately be reduced. And it's interesting. It's fascinating to me. And, you know, Dee Dee, of course, has a lot of opinions about this, so it's fun to watch her try to start to understand, you know, there might be something to, heaven forbid, being a well-adjusted individual, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Sir Lisa Gardner, number one New York Times bestselling author of the Dee Dee Warren series. Go to lisagardner.com. for a lot more information on the book here, Fear Nothing, the other books in the series. So when you're kind of done with it, when you're done with the book Fear Nothing and you start putting it out there, what was one of the first reactions you got back from either your editor or the people involved in the publishing? When it was like when you kind of had your first draft out there, I mean, was it like, wow, or did they kind of have, you know, some I mean, did they kind of have a little bit like, you know, ooh, you know, do you want to soften this up a little bit? Because, you know, you got some scenes in there, I'm telling you. There's some people that are, it's a thriller. There's ain't no doubt about that.
Well, I got two reactions. The first one was very flattering. It was, this is one of the most emotionally powerful books I've ever read. I mean, even both my editors were like, they were deeply affected by the ending, and they're pretty seasoned veteran editors. It's hard to touch their hearts. Let's put it that way. They'll tell you they read so much. And then the second comment I got, which was, I did do some work on, and you've already nailed it on the head, this is a violent book. I mean, it's about two daughters who came from a really violent, I mean, Harry Day himself was a terrible person. Shayna Day is a little better. And then the thing we haven't really touched on yet is one of the things that inspired the novel was all the latest forensics technique and blood spatter analysis. So by definition,
right.
You know, went into the making of the novel.
That's right.
So you're actually reading the kinder, gentler version. Let me put it that way.
Really? There was a
yes.
there was a harsher version, I guess, or a rougher one than this.
Yeah, there was.
Wow, that's what you call the B-side cut. That's the rough cut.
Yeah, it's fun when I have to talk about the book, you know, if people are actually like eating dinner and stuff, and I'm like blood spatter and this and that, and they're like, what?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm sorry, what do you talk about at dinner? I've forgotten what normal people are like.
Right. I mean that's true. And like I said, I mean, there are some scenes in there that will just make you, I was like shaking my head like, wow, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I take the bus sometimes to work, and I was reading it when I was down there, and there were some scenes where I laughed out loud, and I caught myself, and I'm looking around like, oh, God, did they think I'm crazy because I'm laughing out loud at a book? But, it is very emotional because it goes from laughing to cringing where like, oh my God, what the hell just happened? And then you just start laughing about something, you know, and it is. I can definitely see it's a wide range of emotions, which is why, you know, when I reviewed it, I said it was a very intelligent, sophisticated psychological thriller because it kind of encompasses all those things.
Well, I definitely believe a lot in gallows humor. If you spend any time around, you know, police officers, EMTs, first responders, it takes a lot of humor on the job. And particularly if you're going to write a darker book, I think you have to have those moments because it captures more the people involved, too. That is what it takes to do this kind of work. You have to have a sense of humor about it all, too.
Yeah. So now, where are you going to be at? What kind of tour you got going on? Where can readers kind of maybe catch up with you for the book here that you're promoting out there?
So as of an hour ago, I arrived in Portland, Oregon. I'll be doing an event for Howells. Yep, an absolutely legendary independent bookstore here in the Beaverton area. And if people are not doing anything in the Saturday afternoon, I hope they can join us. Then I return to Boston for another event. And then I'm going to settle in because this is wrapping up book tour for me, and I'm going to work on the next novel.
So now what's your goal then for 2014? What kind of New Year's resolution did you set for yourself?
Well, the first one was to survive book tour. So far, so good because I'm down to the last 3 days.
Good. You got no Melvins. You got no Melvins after you, right? You got your Melvin free?
Unfortunately, Melvin follows me on book tour. Traveling's hard on the body. it really is. But I'm looking forward to I'm really excited for the next novel. It's going to be a sequel to Touch and Go. It's going to bring back my New Hampshire detective. It's going to involve 3D printing, which I think is actually some of the cooler technology for the criminal world. Often I'm inspired by forensics, but why not new criminal technology? And, you know, writing is always when I'm at happiest, so I'm looking forward to about to sit down and spend a nice cold wintry New Hampshire winter at the rate we're going, curled up with a computer, hopefully writing a great book.
And so the next one is going to be it's going to be a Tessa Leona book. It's not going to be a Dee Dee Warren.
Yes, there'll be a small part where some part of it takes place in Boston, so we can you know, catch up with Dee Dee, but it won't be a primary case for her.
Oh,
that's
so you're kind of stepping out a little bit, you know,
that's
good. It kind of keeps it fresh, kind of keeps that thing going. And the 3D technology is very interesting because, of course, the 3D computers, didn't somebody just create an actual gun that can pass through a metal detector with a 3D computer?
Yeah.
I remember seeing like that. That is very dangerous stuff that is going on. So that's great that you're going to dive into that world And I'm sure you've already done a lot of research and probably shaking your head at, like, holy shit, this is what's going on.
You know, I think as long as the real world continues, I will never run out of book ideas. You know?
Exactly. So at the pace we're going, I mean, oh, my Lord, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on out there. So, yeah, I get you. But I know that the weather up in Portland is probably a little bit chilly, a little chillier than we are down in Southern California, and I know the rain's coming in, so you better sock it in and be good.
Yeah, it's
and have
nice
fun at Palos.
But yesterday I was in San Diego, so I was closer to you in Southern California, and I have to say I did an event for Mysterious Galaxy. If anyone's interested in signed books, they have plenty. And
yeah.
Oh, what a fabulous bookstore. The best part of book tour is walking into all these great mystery bookstores. It's like being a kid in a candy store.
I know, it is, isn't it? And then they're going away.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing. So, yeah, I get you. Well, I'll tell you what, Lisa, I mean, it is always a pleasure to talk with you and catch up with you, and I know that you have an event going too, and we just want to thank you for taking the time out to be able to speak with us. And, hey, we love you. Nothing but the best. And we'll see you in July in Thriller Fest if you're going to be there.
I will.
So we will be there. Yeah, so we will catch up again. And, again, thank you so much, and good luck.
Great. I'll see you there, John. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is New York Times, number one New York Times bestselling author, Lisa Gardner, with her latest D.D. Warren novel called Fear Nothing. And it is a book about pain in every sense of the world, whether you can feel it or whether you can dish it out or whether you cannot feel it. It is an emotional ride. It is a serious, sophisticated psychological thriller. And I'm telling you, I do not read books fast. For some reason, I just don't read books fast. Maybe that's because after I read 50 pages, I start to close my eyes. But this one I read in no less than 2 days, and it just jumps off the page. Lisa, again, has just amped herself up. But like I said, she has put herself on the very, very short list of top thriller writers that are out there today, and this is one not to be missed. You can get it in Kindle. You can get it in hardcover, paper, whatever you need to get it in. Not paperback yet, but hardcover, Kindle. It's available now through Amazon and every place else. So we want to thank all the people here to our show, our inaugural show here, 2014. Author John Trudell came out here with his book, Soft Target. Then we talked with Paul D. Parsons and the third book in his series, his Baden-Powell Beat series called Ackham. And M.L. Rowland with her book, Zero Degree. So, again, we've got a lot of exciting things going on here. A lot of exciting things on the radio show, Crime and Science Radio, with Doug Lyle, Jan Burke. We've got some great guests coming up here in 2014 with them. Don't forget, they're going to have a Jefferson Bass interview, which is just going to be, I mean, it's absolutely going to be fascinating, the stuff that they have done. The stuff that he has done and everything else. So it is absolutely fascinating interview that you guys cannot miss. And check out all the stuff. Go to suspensemagazine.com, click on Suspense Radio. The website we are getting up, there's a lot of changes that we're going to have going on, hopefully, to the magazine soon. With that website, we are doing a lot of exciting things to make it a lot bigger, a lot better, a lot more fan-friendly, and a lot more information that you guys can have a lot more information. So stick with us. Have fun. Check you guys all out. Don't forget Stranger Than Fiction with Donald Alan Kirsch aired last night, too. He did something about The Exorcist. So you got to check out everything we got going on. So until next time, everybody, we will see you back on here in 2 weeks with Suspense Radio. Check out Crime and Science Radio next Saturday. Goodbye and good luck. Happy 2014. Hope it's a great one for you.